This is the Crystal Ball Run Podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in today. I'm Kevin McGuire, joined today by Andy Coppins. Andy, how's it going, my man?
Hey, not too bad. Can't complain. Even though it is the off-season of the off-season, there never seems to be a shortage of strange or crazy or mixed-up stuff going on in the world of college football.
Yes, absolutely. This is our first podcast in a while, so we obviously have a lot to get caught up on. And I don't know how much we'll actually catch up, but we'll probably just dive in with everything that's going on right now. But before we get into some of these stories that we want to talk about today, just want to remind everybody that you can follow the Crystal Ball Run podcast on iTunes. If you are subscribed on iTunes, we are doing some tinkering behind the scenes, so we are going to be updating the iTunes feed. So if you don't get it, Don't panic. You're going to be getting it very soon. So we'll get that all squared away. In the meantime, make sure you do follow Crystal Ball Run at crystalballrun.com. You can check us out on Twitter, on Facebook, and we're also on Google Plus as well. If you want to check us out on Twitter, it's at Crystal Ball Run. Facebook, it's facebook.com/crystalballrun. And if you're on Google Plus, just search for Crystal Ball Run. You'll pop us up. So Andy, like you said, it's the off season, but you know, obviously, at Crystal Ball Run, we have no off season, and there is a lot to talk about. Spring football is basically coming to a close across the country. A lot of the schools have already put together their spring practices and their spring games, and we've got a few more that are coming up this weekend as we kind of move on to the summer and focus a lot on the conference media days that will be coming up over time. But I think the biggest topic that we need to discuss right now is free crab legs at your nearest grocery store. Did you go to the grocery store yesterday, and how many crab legs did you make off with?
I just didn't do that. The other part is there's no Publix in Chicago, so
that's true. I have got no Publix up here as well. I've got Giant and ShopRite. I don't know what you guys have out there in Chicago. But obviously, we are referring to the reigning Heisman Trophy winner from Florida State, your BCS championship quarterback, Jameis Winston, who was given a civil citation for alleged shoplifting this week. He has to serve 20 hours of community service, made off with some crab legs. I don't know the whole story behind the scenes, but to me, it first comes off as a young college student doing something stupid, which is certainly nothing new. But when you're the Heisman Trophy winner and the face of a championship caliber program like Florida State, it obviously gets blown completely, I'm not going to say out of proportion because it is still stupid. But we saw the internet just take this and run wild with it. I got a kick out of it, I must say.
Well, my question to you, Kevin, is, considering the fact that we're heading into this offseason, would you say that you're a little crabby? No, yeah. But I mean, seriously, some of it's funny, and you can, if this was anybody else, here's where I come off with this. If this was anybody else in the country, maybe save for Johnny Manziel and a few other select individuals, maybe Darrell Green Beckham and some of the other guys, this would be funny and chalk it up to, being young, stupid, and maybe being this big man on campus type of an attitude. But when you take a look at Jameis Winston and his history, this isn't the first, this isn't the second, this isn't the third, this is the fourth time that he's gone through, something either criminal or civil, or, they're looking at certain things that have happened, whether academically or whether it's the alleged rape incident or some of the other things. He continues to show a pattern of dumb decision making, and he seems to also not learn from those dumb decisions to make smart ones going forward.
Yeah, I do feel that there is some merit to this conversation. Like we said, when you are Jameis Winston, you win a Heisman Trophy, you're at Florida State, you're going to be in the public spotlight a lot more than, say, the third string running back at some middle conference program. So I don't want to say that just because he is Jameis Winston, it's more important than any other case. But like you said, there is a pattern, I guess, possibly some history with Jameis Winston that makes you question where his mindset is at this point in time. He is going to be taking on a lot more responsibility as Florida State continues on to the 2014 season. He's going to be under a microscope in just about every aspect, just like we saw with Johnny Manziel after he won the Heisman Trophy last year. Really any Heisman Trophy winner, any player who leads his team to a championship is going to have a lot more expected of him, and he cannot put himself in situations like that.
Oh, yeah, I 100% agree with that. And I think, you know, here's where I come down to is I'm not saying that, you know, the importance is the same. You know, I'm not saying that shoplifting and maybe an alleged rape or you know, things of that nature are the same. I'm not conflating the two and making the connection that X equals Y. Right. What I'm saying is that X plus Y plus Z plus A equals bad decision making all the way around. And it's funny too because, you know, he's the one who's been well aware of what happens when you make bad decisions, because he's mentioned not wanting to, you know, have quote unquote Menzel disease, and he's got it.
Yeah, well, I mean, he isn't sitting courtside at playoff games just yet, but I get your point. Your point is well taken, and it's going to be, like you said, you know, we'll see what happens over the summer. You know, what does he do when he's away from the football program, away from school, I guess? You know, is he going to be in more situations that raise an eyebrow? And that's going to be something that Jimbo Fisher certainly is going to have to, you know, be concerned about moving forward. Now, it is kind of interesting. You know, I think the latest update out there was that Winston, who plays baseball for Florida State, is going to be suspended from the baseball team for a while. And Jimbo Fisher said that he fully endorses that suspension, which I think is kind of interesting because it almost takes him off the hook for having to do anything as far as football is concerned. You know, I don't know if, you know, if he wasn't playing baseball, I don't know if there would be some kind of punishment as far as football is concerned when the season starts, whether he sits out the first series or the first quarter like we saw Manziel last year in the season opener. I don't know if that would be the case or not for this. But it is kind of interesting to see how it's handled. Is being, you know, suspended from the baseball team enough? Is there going to be anything that Fisher has to do, you think?
I don't necessarily think there's a lot that Fisher will have to do with this case because it happened in the off season. I mean, what do? You suspend him indefinitely, not allow him to practice, and then throw him raw into a game against what is a very, you know, highly qualified Oklahoma State team. It's going to be very interesting to see what happens.
Yeah, I mean, there is precedent for players sitting out the first quarter or the first half of the season opener. So, I mean, there is a background there as far as that's concerned. Just because you get in trouble in the offseason doesn't necessarily take you off the hook once the season comes around. And again, is this that serious? I don't know. Will there be anything else? Who knows what's going to happen? But it was kind of funny at first with all the Photoshops that were making the rounds on Twitter, and they are kind of humorous. But there are some important discussion points in this story as well. So let's move on from that. Let's talk about some of the other big things that were going on this week. A lot of buzz surrounding the SEC football scheduling policy, which was released on Sunday. For anyone who doesn't know already know, the SEC said that they are going to continue moving forward with an 8-game conference schedule. In those 8 games will be one protected crossover game between divisions. And the SEC is also requiring all members to schedule at least one opponent from any of the other power conferences, the ACC, the Big Ten, the Big 12, the Pac-12. There's some kind of mixed emotions on that, and you know whether or not that's fair, the way that this policy was set up. You know, you and I, obviously Andy from a Big Ten territory, we're very familiar with all the Big Ten scheduling conversations that have been taking place. Mm-hmm. What was your reaction when you saw what the SEC is requiring their teams to do?
You know, I don't understand it, because what the SEC is doing is kind of putting themselves on an island in terms of their scheduling. You look at where, you know, the Big 12, obviously with their round robin scheduling, have 9 conference games. The Big 10 is moving to 9 conference games. The Pac-12, if I remember correctly, is moving to that 9 conference game schedule as well. And that was the reason why the Big 10 Pac-12 agreement didn't work.
Right.
And so for me, I have a little bit of mixed emotions. I understand, you know, maybe competitive balance, this, that, or the other thing. But you also have an ability, I think, if you're the SEC with that added conference game, to, you know, one, sell your property better, and two, you have the ability to also allow yourself an opportunity to show the critics of some of your scheduling that you're not scheduling softball opponents, you know, in cross division games. Because if you take a look at what's going to happen, you're going to get, you know, let's say Florida, Texas A&M. You're going to get that matchup once every 12 years. I mean, that's what it's going to come down to. And I just don't think that that's healthy for the SEC. I don't think you get a good competitive balance by doing so.
Yeah, I think when you look at the way that these pairings are, you know, Alabama gets Tennessee, Auburn gets Georgia. There's some great history. There's great tradition with those matchups. Not so much with Texas A&M and South Carolina, which we're going to get every year. I guess, I forget some of the other pairings off the top of my head, but there's a lot to be desired, and that's why I think what we've seen is from certain schools, LSU specifically, there's some displeasure with the way that this policy was set up, because when you lock in that crossover division game on an annual basis, you are limiting the exposure to the rest of the conference that you're going to see. Like you just said, it could be 12 years between a Florida and Texas A&M game for whatever reason. And that to me is one of the biggest problems with the whole realignment process that we've been going through, the expansion process we've been going through around the country. Because we only have a 13-game schedule, there's not a whole lot of wiggle room when you expand to 12-member conferences, 14-member conferences as the SEC is, the ACC is 14, Big Ten is soon going to be 14. So there's not a lot of room. That's why you see that 9-game conference schedule conversation pop up, and that's I'm a little surprised that the SEC didn't go with the 9-game schedule, because let's not forget they also have an SEC network that's coming out this summer. You figure the inventory that they want to add to that, there's a lot of demand for SEC football, especially in that within that region. You would think that they want to put forth a better overall product, but you know, we'll see what happens, because a lot of the onus is now on the schools to go out and be able to work out deals with opponents from these other conferences. Now, what they do with those games, are they going to be going for Ohio State and Michigan and USC and Oregon, or are they going to be going for Indiana, Duke, the bottom feeders like that? And I think that's one of the things that's going to be could backfire on them. Who knows?
Well, and I think, you know, the other part of this is if you're Vanderbilt, if you're Mississippi State, if you're Kentucky, you know, some of these other schools, I mean, Kentucky's a little bit of a different situation because they have that rivalry with Louisville,
right?
So that game can always count towards that requirement.
Exactly.
But if you're the Mississippi States, the Ole Misses, the Arkansas of the world, where scheduling you on an annual basis is not necessarily going to be something that the higher end, the bigger named programs, what does it technically do for you? Is there really an advantage to doing that? Do you really want to see Mississippi State, Oregon State? I mean, how many people are going to actually tune in for that game versus, you know, let's say keeping it regional for those guys and maybe going and scheduling, a Big 12 opponent or scheduling, you know, a Conference USA opponent that's, you know, closer regionally to them. I really don't understand the mindset with this, because let's face facts. I mean, the SEC is regional in terms of its draw.
Right.
The Pac-12 is not interested in what's happening with Mississippi State or Vanderbilt, or, you know, there's just not a lot of that going on out west, whereas there's interest in the Big Ten with the Pac-12. And, you know, there's some – I don't know. I'd like to see how this plays out. I'm a little bit mixed on it. But, you know, the other part for me, Kevin, is – the SEC is basing this on who they are now. And 10 years ago, they weren't who they are now. And are they going to be 10 years from now who they are now? Because they're locking themselves in for that schedule agreement for at least the next 6 to 8 to possibly 10 years.
Yeah, there is a big commitment that's going to be made. And, you know, things can always change along the way if there's really a concern or a pressing need from within the conference membership. I think they can always probably change things, but it's, you know, it is a commitment that they're going to have to really hope plays out the way that they are expecting it to. Now, of course, the trends are that, you know, you look at the population models, the population movement in this country, and there's suggestions that SEC football is going to be around for a while now. You know, maybe not quite at the clear-cut number one across the country, but they're going to be pretty talented for a while, but there are going to be some issues, I think, that pop up from this. And I don't know where they're going to be, but I think they're going to need a lot of cooperation and some willing participants from some of the other conferences. And I've seen some people say, you know, and I had this thought myself, it's like, why would the Big Ten and the ACC, Pac-12 and Big 12, why would they just give in to that SEC requirement. What would happen, theoretically, if none of those schools from those conferences wanted to schedule a game? You know, could the SEC actually punish a team for not being able to set up a game? I mean, the odds are everybody's going to be able to find a game because there are enough teams out there from those conferences. But, you know, it's just a what-if question.
Yeah, and I think it's a great what-if question because let's not forget that, you know, with that nine-game conference schedule, the imbalance that happens in home and away games, there are a lot of moving parts. For instance, a great example of this is a place like the University of Iowa. Every other year, they have that rivalry at home and away with Iowa State from the Big 12. Are you really going to be able to schedule an SEC opponent on top of that for a home and away series? I mean, you have to fit every little piece of that puzzle has to fit exactly right for something like that to occur. And then you also, okay, so you're going to play a Big 12 opponent, an SEC opponent, and then one cupcake? If you're a program like Iowa, that's a recipe for failure for you guys, you know? So I think it's very intriguing to see what this is going to do domino-wise for the rest of college football.
Yeah, if I read it correctly, I think the scheduling policy that's asking teams to find opponents from those other conferences, I believe that starts in 2016. Now, the problem that, like you're alluding to, is a lot of these teams from these conferences, probably more so the bigger names, the top names, they like to schedule very far in advance whenever they can. You know, I mean, we've got Ohio State, Virginia Tech that signed up for some games years in advance. You know, Penn State has opponents from, West Virginia and Pittsburgh lined up for, you know, the next 6 to 8 years, whatever that is, Syracuse as well. You know, you see a lot of those schools lock up those non-conference schedules, and then they really, you know, they pad the rest of their non-conference schedule with teams from the other conferences, and maybe an FCS team along the way. So it is going to be very difficult, and I would be very curious. I didn't even dig that deep into it because there's going to be a lot of teams that probably aren't going to be interested at all. Unless a TV partner, ESPN, comes in and cuts a nice check for a nice neutral site game or something like that. That's always something that's going to have to be under consideration as well, especially when the SEC and ESPN have that newly rekindled, but they have that relationship through the SEC network. They're going to want to make things happen.
Yeah, I totally agree with you on that. And, you know, I think a great example is that Wisconsin's only been able to get, are you going to get home and home games? I think, you know, what we run the risk of with the SEC doing this is setting up so many neutral site games that the fans get turned off, because part of the draw of college football is the game day atmosphere. And it just doesn't, you know, it doesn't equate when you go to a neutral site atmosphere.
And you said Wisconsin, of course. Wisconsin and LSU have that two-game series that'll be played in NFL stadiums to beyond my comprehension. But I understand NFL stadiums, probably more money to be made. You know, it loses the atmosphere, but it's still going to be pretty interesting to see how it all plays out. I guess, speaking of Wisconsin, is there any demand in Madison? I know you're not in Madison, but is there any demand from what you're hearing to get a series started up with Arkansas?
I think there's some, just because it might be an easy win. No, I think it would be very intriguing to see that matchup happen. I know last year some people were pushing for, you know, Bama to maybe make a small run in the SEC and get into position where they could have played in the Outback Bowl against the Outback Bowl or the Capital One Bowl against Wisconsin, but that just didn't happen.
No, it did not. I don't think Arkansas is going to be down for too long, but that's another topic for another day. Let's talk about the college football playoff on the selection committee. A lot of details coming out this week as they're all meeting and trying to put together everything that they're going to be doing for this upcoming season, which is going to be a learning experience for everybody. And Andy, I don't know how deep you got into what the selection committee's process is going to be when it comes time to putting together their own top 25 ballot, but I'll kind of run through some of the basics of it. Here's what we know. The selection committee, they're going to have their own top 25 ranking. So we will have, I think, four different top 25 rankings at some point this season, or not top 25, but rankings at some point this season.
Right.
They're doing this as a way to be kind of transparent with the fans and kind of take them behind the scenes and let us get a little bit of insight on where they're heading with their plans for picking teams for the playoff system, and they're going to be releasing a top 25 ranking every Tuesday night starting in late October. It's going to be televised by ESPN, of course, because we need to have television programs about rankings, of course, and hopefully that's going to lead into some Tuesday night action, but we'll wait to see how that all plays out. Here's what we know. The selection committee, starting every Monday, they're going to be working behind the scenes, and they're going to put together their own top 25 ranking. And as I was going through it, it looks like it's going to be a very tiresome process. They're going to be going through, they're going to list their top 25 teams, and the top six teams that are on everybody's rankings are going to be put into a pool. And then you have to rank the top, those top six teams. The top three of those teams will move on, and they are locked in to numbers one through three. And then you take the next six best teams, and you rank them. You take the top three of that group, and you put them behind the top three. You go through that process however many times until you have a full top 25 ranking. And to me, it sounds incredibly tedious, maybe a little painstaking. And honestly, I'm not even sure how much value there really is to that kind of process for this.
I agree that it's painstaking and tedious, but here's the difference between that and what we got out of the old BCS system. They're actually having to think. And and here's the deal with that, because, okay, you and I have put together our own top 25s for various organizations and in various situations. It's, if you take it seriously, you do exactly what they're doing. You break down, you know, different teams. You kind of do it internally. But what this allows them to do is to get a, you know, a chorus of opinions and get it right, instead of just, you know, okay, what was wrong with the old top 25 system was, you know, you could theoretically, I mean, it would take a little bit of work, but theoretically you could just rig it so that, you know, if I vote team XYZ and five other people vote it this way, that team gets, you know, a certain spot or a certain percentage. Mm-hmm. In this system, you can't do that. It's a fail-safe because you have to vote on every tier. You can't just vote your top 25 and then allow the other 12 members to do it. I think there's a fail-safe to this, and I like that portion of it.
Yeah, and the one thing I actually, when I was running through it, I didn't mention, there is a debate and discussion before each vote is counted. And that's one, mm-hmm. that's one of the reasons that this is going to be very time-consuming. But I think you're right. I think you, when you take the time to really weigh all the options and all the opinions, you do get a concrete and consensus vote. And I think that there is some benefit there. But ultimately, how important is it to see a top 25 ranking from the selection committee in late October, mid-November, when really all that really matters for this selection committee is getting the final four teams right when it comes time to putting together that playoff at the end?
Yeah, I get that. But at the same point in time, you know, there are two reasons for this. I think one is America loves rankings. Let's face it. I mean, have you been to BuzzFeed lately?
A $1 billion organization, and, if you believe that, what they say.
Exactly. But and the other part of that situation for me too, Kevin, is that teams and administrators and fans know, have an idea of where their team is heading mm-hmm. according to the system that is involved. And I think that's important. There's no RPI ranking in college football. There's no, you know, concrete evidence. And this is the only concrete evidence you're going to get. And I think that's important. Let's also not forget that teams are also going to be vying for and playing for, you know, the other college football playoff bowl games.
Right.
So, you know, you're looking at, you know, that top six, top eight being very important economically for a lot of programs.
One of the quotes that came out from Jeff Long from Arkansas, he's the chairman of the committee. One of the things that he said was the committee is going to focus on putting together the best teams, not necessarily the most deserving teams. And I think it's a quote that probably rubbed a lot of people the wrong way, myself included, especially at first. But I think when you really take time to think about it, that first of all, that is their goal, to find the best teams and put them in a playoff. But are the best teams always going to be the most deserving teams? I think that's one of the kind of gray areas that they're leaving themselves open for. And I think a lot of people make the Boise State comparison. You know, Boise State goes 12-0, wins the Mountain West. You know, where would they rank against all of the conference champions from the other conference, the power conferences, with one loss? I mean, would Boise State get into that mix? They would probably be deserving of it, but would they necessarily be referred to as the best?
You know, and that's always going to be an argument. But the other part, I think, what Jeff Long was saying is that it's not going to matter what conference you're in. Mm-hmm. What they're looking at is the body of work that you've put out. Now, if you're a Boise State, if you're, you know, a Northern Illinois or a Bowling Green or, you know, some of these other programs that have kind of risen over the last couple of years, what you have to be able to do and point to, like Northern Illinois was able to do had they won the MAC championship game last year,
right,
is that they went out and beat multiple Big Ten opponents. You know, so they have a resume to look at and compare to other Big Ten teams, to other big conference teams, and say, hey, look, you know, here's how we played against these teams, and, you know, here's what we did. So I think, you know, there's a component to being the best and showing that on the field. But they also, I think, you know, any game is available to these guys. They can see on a weekly basis just how good a Boise State really is on film. You know, you've got a Barry Alvarez in there. You've got a ton of guys that know their football and can break down just how good those teams are. And I think that's really important to coming up with, well, they should be deserving because they're 12-0, but here's why they are one of the best.
And, you know, one thing that you kind of mentioned there was that they're going to take time to really review all the stuff. They're not going to be starting to put together their top 25 rankings until Monday. Monday afternoon is when they're going to officially start. So they have plenty of time to review all the material, which I think is going to probably ease some of the concerns with how serious they're going to take this job. You know, when you have your ranking systems during the season, you have the Associated Press poll, you have the coaches poll. They both come out Sunday, probably Sunday morning, maybe. There's not a whole lot of time to really, you know, dive into everything that happened on that previous Saturday or the couple nights before that. So, and we know that how some of these ballots work. You know, they have the top 25 rankings. That, oh, this team lost. Okay, I'll drop them a couple spots. This team won. All right, I'll move them up. The coaches' poll is probably even less cumbersome for some because they just have an assistant fill it out and send it in. But that's one thing I do like, the fact that they will wait a little bit. They'll digest everything a little bit more, hopefully, and they'll really take the time to really think about the process. And, you know, it's going to be fun to watch unfold, I think. And I think that a lot of people are still going to have some concerns, you know, questions about it. But it's all new to everybody, and that's kind of exciting, I think.
Well, and the other part for me, Kevin, is if the, you know, people with concerns about this are going to, you know, piss and moan about any system that's going to be set up. Because if you think this system doesn't work, what the hell are you thinking when the AP and coaches polls were voting for a champion? I mean, seriously, think about that. If this system, which is designed to be able to allow teams to play on the football field for a championship, is something you're against, but you were also against the just arbitrary voting of a sports writer's opinion or maybe an SID's opinion and sometimes a coach.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, think about these things logically. This is a serious, you know, no-nonsense approach to what's happening in college football without actually creating a physical 16-team, you know, a conference champion plays conference champion type of a playoff system.
Andy, I do want to move on to a couple other things, but before we finish up with the college football playoff talk, I want to just quickly mention there was a poll conducted by CBSSports.com this week polling different athletic directors, and I forget the exact numbers of how many they asked and how many responded, but the majority of those who did respond believe that this college football playoff field is going to expand beyond four teams before the end of the deal that's currently in place. And that, to me, is not all that surprising that people really are thinking that already. And again, it's, you know, maybe a small sample size compared to what, you know, the college football membership actually has. But to me, this is going to expand at some point. It's just a matter of when, just not if.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you on that. I think the writing's kind of been on the wall with how they've set up, you know, six bowl games and, you know, this, that, or the other thing. If you just take four of them and leave the other two for maybe the you know, 9, 10, 11, 12 teams and allow them to play and maybe showcase themselves for the next season. You know, I think, you know, that's the other part of this too. I think there's an opportunity for the teams that are left out to go out and win bowl games and at least set themselves up to show the committee that they have the capability of playing at that extremely high level. I think, you know, the other part of this, and Kevin, you know this as well as I do, it's about money. And if they can get more money for an 8-game playoff, and, you know, we're talking, you know, instead of a billion and a half, we're talking $2.5 billion or $2 billion with a B, you know, they're going to do it. And I don't necessarily have a problem with that, because for me, I think you can make an argument that at least there are 8 quality teams that could theoretically win a national championship in college football. I mean, let's think about it. It's 126 now, or 125?
I believe it's 125 this year.
Yeah, 125, soon to be 126 when Charlotte joins. That's right.
Right, right.
But yeah, so 125 teams, and there are only 4 that are, you know, national championship caliber. It's a interesting argument to make.
Well, I mean, the people that would argue it would say, are there really 4 teams worthy of playing for a national championship? If you look at the history of the BCS system, at least, you know, 1 and 2 usually pretty good. 3 can probably usually make a case. Is there really a strong argument for 4?
Tell Michigan State that last year.
I'm just playing contrarian to you right now.
Right, exactly. But there's the other argument. You can point to, you know, tell Stanford, tell Oregon from a few years ago, that team that beat Wisconsin in the Rose Bowl, that team could have won a national championship. Now, you can say, well, they should have gone undefeated. You could have said that about Alabama that year, or a number of other teams that, you know, that only had 1 loss. You know, so you can make that argument over and over again. And heck, you could have made that argument about that Wisconsin team that lost to Oregon by, you know, less than a touchdown in that game, too. So, you know, there are arguments to be made about these teams. And I personally would rather just have those arguments settled on the field than, you know, talking about them ad nauseum, you know, forever in the offseason.
What I was going to try and say was, maybe you can make those arguments when there are 4 teams involved, but how many arguments can be made for all 8 teams? And I think that's what people are going to say. I don't necessarily agree with it. I actually like the idea of expanding it to 8 at some point. I want to see how this 4-team playoff plays out first. So let's not get too far ahead of ourselves. Let's just unwind. Let's sit back and let's see how this all plays out first. And let's see, you know, how year 1 goes, and we'll look at the pros and the cons then.
And the other part of this, too, and I think one thing that I want to nip in the bud while we're talking about this is people are going to harp on the results of these games. You know, Team A and Team B won by 30 points, so therefore Teams C and D are garbage.
Right.
It's 1 game.
Yeah.
You know, if they played that game 10 times, how many times would that result actually happen? You know, you can only take a game in and of itself, especially in that type of a scenario, as a one-off. You can't say that that's indicative of who that team is.
100% agree. 100% agree. And that's always the way it's been, and, you know, there are always going to be people that do that. But, yeah, 1 game is 1 game, and it doesn't necessarily – I always say I'm sure some coach said this, and I can't remember exactly who's credited with saying it, but you're never as good as your best game. You're never as bad as your worst game. You're always going to be somewhere in between. Yeah, I've always believed that, and I think that's a pretty good philosophy. Want to talk about, real quick, maybe the union talk that's been going on. Not so much happened this week, but I figure we should at least touch on it because there have been some interesting developments. And you're right in the center of where it's all taking place. I wanted to get your take. What's the reaction now with the Northwestern players and their union? We obviously know they voted, the players voted, but we won't know the result of those votes for an undetermined amount of time. You know, what's the latest going on with that?
Well, I think, you know, just to catch people up, obviously April 24th, there was the Board of Trustees vote that granted or put forward the 5 conferences, the 5 power conferences, ACC, Big 12, Big 10, Pac-12, SEC. They're going to have autonomy to kind of deal with some of the issues that the union movement, Kappa, College Athletes Players Association, has been pushing for. The other part was the next day, literally, I believe, almost 24 hours later, the Northwestern players voted on campus in a sealed secret vote. And because not only because that vote was secret, but because the National Labor Relations Board, their national committee, is going to grant the hearing for Northwestern, the appeal for Northwestern. That vote is sealed and will not be opened until that hearing resolves itself. I think, you know, the interesting part of that for me, Kevin, is that if the NLRB agreed wholeheartedly with what the Chicago board said and how they went about doing things, there would be no need to grant this appeal. And the other part for me is I have a feeling from talking to people around the program, talking to other media members that cover this team, that that vote was a pretty strong no. And especially when you start talking about people like Trevor Siemian, I believe Colin Ellis is the other one that you need to pay attention to. The big leaders on this football team were very vocal prior to the vote about voting no. Because I think what they wanted to do was to have a voice, and I think that they thought this would be a way to get a voice. But then when they really looked at what this would do, to their economic benefit or disadvantage and some of the other things, I think they took a step back and realized this is not exactly how to go about this. I think there's a way to bring awareness to these issues and work within the structure that we do have.
I've always said it's nowhere in my responsibility to tell, you know, people whether or not they should be voting for a union or against a union. I don't really care. I want the players to have a voice. That's what I'm concerned about. If a union is their best way to do it, so be it. If they want to find another way, I'm fine with that too. I do feel that they need to have more voice as far as the NCAA and maybe some universities, not necessarily Northwestern, but I think they need to have a voice more at some of their universities. But what I'm saying here is I wanted the players to have their vote and vote the way they feel they need to vote. Once they review all the information, they get all the opinions, and they really think about what's best for them and maybe players going forward at Northwestern, you know, I want them to take the vote seriously, and I want them to vote for really what they want to do. So if they vote for a union, great. If they vote against a union, okay, that's fine too. But my concern is the outside influences that supposedly were being reported. There's some concerns about what administrators, I guess, maybe even some coaches may have been doing to influence the decision. Now, I don't know if that's the case. I'm not saying it is the case, but
I can flat out tell you that wasn't the case.
Okay, that's
just being able to just being around the program. Okay. and talking, I can flat out tell you they had a script. That script was pre-approved by lawyers to make sure that it was,
right,
within the law, within how they were able to go about that. There's a difference between giving them facts and telling them how to vote, and that's what Northwestern was doing. If you take a look at the document that was released, I think CBS Sports got it and the Chicago Tribune had it as well. I can flat out tell you that there was no quote-unquote pressuring. I mean, that would be the dumbest thing that Northwestern as an administration and as a coaching staff could have done in this situation. If anything, there might have been more pressure from I think it's the United Steelworkers – and some of the other parts, Kane Coulter, came in and gave a speech, and Kappa came in and gave a speech. So that both sides of the equation had their say in this issue. So, a back and forth between them, unfair labor practice, whatever. You can look at the document and, if Northwestern has a lawyer dumb enough to break the law, you got to question a Northwestern law degree at some point.
Yeah, and that was actually always the impression I got. I figured a guy like Pat Fitzgerald, he's going to give his players as much information because he is thinking about their well-being, I think. Mm-hmm. I firmly believe that, and I always have, even though he is against that union. I don't think he was going to do what he could to influence a vote. I think he's always got his players' best intentions in mind, and I firmly believe that that was always going to be the case. So we can officially put that to rest. There is no issue there as far as that's concerned. Now, what I am curious to see is how this all plays out. Which way did those players vote? If they vote no and that appeal from the university was overturned or rejected anyway, that vote is still significant. I don't know if it actually puts to rest the whole union movement, because I think that there are other programs and there are players at other programs who are keeping a close eye on this because they want to see how this all plays out at Northwestern before potentially exploring the same opportunity at their university. I think USC, Miami players have come out in the past month and expressed an interest, and it would be very interesting to see. I don't think if the players ended up voting no, I don't think that that necessarily prevents another union group from potentially forming at another university.
No, but I think it puts a rather large damper on the situation because, like you mentioned, I think a lot of players are following this closely, and I think the more information that they have, the less likely they are to go this route. I know there's been some Miami players that have talked about it, but again, you're talking about a vote of 85 people, and that means that you have to get the majority of 85 people to agree to do that. And all it takes is, is what, 44 or 45 players to vote no, and you're done. So it's going to be very interesting to see what happens. I think, one of the intriguing ones is Miami, just because of the eccentric nature of that program.
Right.
But the other part for me, Kevin, and I wrote about this in over at Bleacher Report, about some of the schools that might possibly look towards that could be the next wave, so quote-unquote, the backlash in comments from not only fans but boosters. And that's the key. Because without booster money, this whole situation doesn't matter. Right. But the backlash from them saying flat out that they will stop donating, that they will stop, supporting the program if this were to take place at USC, at Miami, you can go ahead and take a look at the comments on that article. They are flat out adamant about that situation. I think that's the real significant part, because that's the important part of any athletic department's lifeline. I mean, they can't survive without booster money, and without booster money, what's the point of a union? You've killed your sport effectively. I think that's the interesting scenario in this whole situation.
Absolutely. And again, it's going to be interesting to see how this all plays out of starting at Northwestern, because there's still a timeline that we're following here. Do you know when this appeal from the university may be heard? Is there a date set for that yet?
There is no date set for that appeal as of yet. My guess is we may know something by the end of the year, but it could be 3 months, it could be 6 months, it could be 9, it could be, it just takes however long it takes the NLRB to kind of set that up, because let's face it, they've got other issues to deal with as well. So
absolutely, and this is certainly nothing that's going to be moving at rapid pace. I think we've really learned that along the way. We're going to have to be patient before we find out all the details and find out where this is heading. One of the other big stories that actually kind of popped up, and again, it's a big story because of the nature of the subject, the Vanderbilt rape case that has been going on now kind of is hitting some new strides right now as the defense team is putting together their arguments and filing documents and coming up with their statements. It ties in James Franklin a little bit, and how it's interpreted, I think, is the big key here. The defense team says that James Franklin, when he was the head coach at Vanderbilt, obviously now the head coach over at Penn State, he made contact with the alleged victim, and he had known who this girl was. I don't know how important that is to this the story here. The way that the defense is kind of throwing it in there, again, the timeline seems kind of jumbled as it was reported. Your impression on James Franklin being tied into this at this point, is there any reason for concern here? Or what's your opinion on this one right now?
Well, if this was any other university that hired James Franklin, I don't think this is a massive story.
Mm-hmm.
But this is Penn State.
Right.
And we all know what has gone on over the past 2.5-3 years at Penn State. I think this part of the scenario at Vanderbilt really bothers me, because when you tie in the alleged reports of, Franklin advising players to delete videos and text messages, whether that's proven true or not, it is an alleged incident. And then you tie in the fact that he knew the victim, that he had spoken to the victim, and that allegedly the other part that bothers me in this is that he had talked about forming a, you know, quote unquote recruiting team of pretty women.
Right.
It's not the first time we've heard James Franklin kind of talk objectively or objectifying women in a certain way. And when you're tying in things of a sexual nature and Penn State, it's right now, it's you got to tread really carefully when you're talking about those situations. And I'm just wondering if, you know, they hadn't found this information or Franklin wasn't as forthcoming in the interview process. I don't know. I'm torn on this issue because, you know, Franklin's done some really good things for Penn State football, kind of brought some of the fervor back and that sort of thing. However, when you're talking about what is an alleged rape and an involvement in some aspect of it, and maybe even a cover-up type of a situation, that really is not good at Penn State.
Yeah, the whole trial for this case is going to be very intense, I'm sure, and there's going to be a lot of information that does come out. And right now, there's still a lot of questions that need to be answered, certainly, and they will be, hopefully. What we do know as far as this morning, the prosecutors in this case have actually come out and said that Franklin's contact with the alleged victim was nothing more than support, or nothing other than support and showing compassion or care or whatever. So the prosecutors don't seem as hesitant on Franklin's role, but they didn't really touch on that other information as far as the recruiting team goes. And obviously, that's not really their top concern at that point. You know, that could be that's.
There's nothing illegal about doing that.
Exactly. I mean,
it's against the NCAA bylaws, yeah, but it's not illegal.
Right. And that's why they're certainly not going to bother themselves with that unless it actually does come up and it really does have a relevant part of the whole conversation. But we'll let that all play out. As far as Penn State is concerned, though, we, like you said, we know exactly what's been going on there. And when Franklin was hired, one of the first things that they tried to make clear as a university was that the vetting process to hire Franklin or hire their next head coach after Bill O'Brien left for the NFL, it was one of the most thorough vetting processes that university has ever done or ever seen. They obviously had to do that, given the talk of this whole scandal at Vanderbilt. Franklin being the head coach, he has to be bearing some responsibility, you would think, on some level. But they needed to make sure that if Franklin was hired, there was going to be absolutely no problem. And maybe that will be the case. We'll have to wait and see. But Penn State says that it's the most thorough vetting process they've ever done. Now how thorough did Penn State do that? That's another question. You know, just because it was their most thorough thing that they've done doesn't necessarily clear them of any wrongdoing or any improper process in there.
But the other part and the other foot of this for Penn State and to kind of play devil's advocate is maybe they knew about this. Maybe they did do the thorough vetting and they're fine with whatever explanation was out there or whatever they found. We don't know what they know. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
We're not access to all of the information that they had access to. So to judge, them and say, well, how thorough was your vetting process that this information is just now coming out? Well, it's just now coming out legally. That doesn't mean that you couldn't have done a background check, done a PI check, and found this information for yourself. We just don't know what all went into it. So I'm not going to sit here and judge. I think, you know, Penn State, they would not have made this hire. You have to believe that the interim people, the people that were in place after Spanier and everybody else, mm-hmm, would not be dumb enough to make a hire that they were not sure could pass a vetting process. And Franklin, for me, I'm going to trust that they did the right thing in this hire.
Andy, if there's one thing I've learned in my time on this planet is never underestimate how dumb some people can be.
You'd have to be really dumb to do something like that.
And that was what I was going to say. It was like when Franklin was hired, I immediately thought about this Vanderbilt situation, and I always thought to myself, and I think I probably said this at some point, either online or in something I wrote, if Penn State is in that position that they've been in, they have to be absolutely sure. They need to do all the checks. They need to do as much investigating as possible before they make that decision to hire Franklin, who's coming from Vanderbilt. Whoever the coach was going to be, they needed to do a whole lot of homework to make sure that this was going to be the right hire. I want to say that I have faith that they did that. We'll see how this all plays out, of course. And I still feel pretty strong that this is going to be a hire that is going to be something that Penn State will not regret. I really do feel that way. I'm curious to see how this all plays out at Vanderbilt, but I feel confident enough to say that Penn State did their homework and they probably knew some of these things could pop up at some point. I don't think they're going to regret it.
And the other thing too, Kevin, is let's not forget that the hire of James Franklin, it wasn't like Bill O'Brien left on New Year's Eve and New Year's Day they hired James Franklin.
Right.
And it took them a good, 2.5, almost 3 weeks to officially make that hire, if I'm remembering the timeline correctly. So, I mean, they had plenty of time to dig into information on every single person, whether it's Al Golden, who had, some alleged issues, especially NCAA issues. And we all know the NCAA and Penn State aren't exactly getting along right now. So, there's a lot of things to really point to Penn State doing the right thing in terms of their vetting process and whatnot. What I would be interested to see is how Penn State comes out and handles this PR-wise. Because what I think would be smart for them to do is whether it's today, whether it's tomorrow, is to get out somewhat in front of this story and just be a little more transparent and say, we are aware of XYZ and we were able to vet that to our satisfaction.
Yeah, and the timing of that is actually pretty important because today, actually, James Franklin and some of the other coaches at Penn State, for some of the other sports programs, they're starting a region-wide bus tour. They've done this the last couple of years since Bill O'Brien was hired. James Franklin's going to be headlining a bus tour throughout Pennsylvania and some of the other neighboring states in the region. So this is going to be on the mind because the media are going to be able to have availability to Franklin and some of the other coaches before his speaking engagements at these alumni events. So it's going to pop up and probably more than once along the way. And I'm sure when I get a chance to stop at one of these stops along the way, I'm sure it's going to be talked about as well. So this is a good time for Penn State to get in front of something and actually address it and maybe put something to rest. So we'll see how that plays out.
No doubt.
Andy, it was good talking to you again and getting this podcast going again on Crystal Ball Run. Like I said at the beginning, we've undergone some changes at crystalballrun.com. If you haven't checked out the website recently, do so, because last month we've had a little bit of a new look. And with that, we're trying to get this podcast back up and running, and we're going to make this hopefully a little bit more accessible to our readers and our listeners. And we hopefully will be able to grab you and bring you into the podcast, bring you on the website, and follow us on Twitter and Facebook. Andy, what do you have going on this week?
Some interesting stuff. We're talking college uniforms because it's the silly season, so why not? That's kind of been the big topic as of late with Nike kind of unveiling all their rebranding that they've gone under, done for Arkansas, Illinois, about 10 other colleges, it seems like. But the other part, obviously, we're going through stuff over at Madtown Badgers, same redesign and everything else. A lot of interesting stuff. And hey, it's the silly season, so you never know when when the next crab gate or maybe the next time it's gonna be hamburger gate. Who knows what's gonna happen throughout the rest of the silly season? But I'm looking forward to it because it always brings some fun stuff. But more importantly, now is the time for us to start looking forward to August 30th or August 28th when the season actually kicks off.
Yeah, I'm definitely looking forward to that. It really gets the itch going at this time of year. This is the 1st of May, and we're only a couple months away from conference media days. Andy, of course, we can follow you on Twitter at AndyOnCFB. I'm Kevin McGuire. You can follow me on Twitter at KevinOnCFB. Those are some great Twitter names, by the way.
And I can't believe I can't imagine where I got mine from.
a truly great inspiration, I'm sure. Of course, you can also follow Crystal Ball Run on Twitter at Crystal Ball Run. Again, we're on Facebook as well, Google Plus, and you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. And again, we will be updating the iTunes feed. So if it's not working for you, just bear with us. We'll get that all situated. CrystalBallRun.com is the website. Andy, hopefully we can do this again soon, and we'll catch up and see what else is going on in the so-called silly season.
No doubt about it. Look forward to it. And like you said, make sure you guys are following Crystal Ball Run. A lot of changes and a lot of fun stuff coming up.